2012, February 16th. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 30, Goldilocks and the Three Planets. To finish our discussion of life in the solar system, I want to come back to some themes we've been developing over the last many lectures, this idea of habitability. What is it that makes the Earth habitable? Now, we've seen some examples of life that can exist perhaps in what should be, at least superficially speaking, very inhospitable places. We've looked at the two most interesting places to search for life in the solar system where there's liquid water, namely underneath the ice of Europa and possibly underneath the ice of Enceladus around Saturn. But I like to think of those as kind of hidden life. They're buried beneath something in order to protect them from the sunlight or from the intense cold of their environments. But if we're going to be looking for life on other worlds, especially around other stars, we really want what I would call visible life, life that actually lives on its surface and maybe leaves markers on its planet that says things live here. We're going to be looking, ultimately, we're going to be developing this idea of biomarkers, the idea that the planet looks habitable. So even though there's a possible very wide range for possible habitability, if you have energy, water, organic chemistry, we still need to get around the fact that we'd like to actually find it. So we want to start developing this idea of how we go looking for life and understanding the criteria for establishing habitability. We're going to see that that's actually this question of what is the place where we expect, what are the factors that determine the habitability of a planet around a star, sets up what's often referred to as a classic Goldilocks problem. Today we're going to be looking at habitability in our solar system from the surfaces by looking at this idea of a habitable zone. Temperature of a planet's surface, now we're going to be talking about surface life, depends upon how far away it is from the sun and how bright the sun is. It also depends upon the planet's albedo, how shiny it is. Those things are going to set up what the equilibrium temperature of the planet is, and one of the factors that determines whether conditions are ripe for having liquid water. So you've got to have an equilibrium temperature that allows for liquid water. Now it turns out the proximity of the planet to the sun, plus the presence of a greenhouse effect, which can change what the outcome of that calculation of the temperature is one of the real important pieces for understanding whether the planet is too hot or too cold to sustain stable liquid water. The size of a planet, as we've seen previously, determines how big of an atmosphere, if any, you can build up. You're going to not only make an atmosphere, but you've got to hold on to it. Your gravity's got to be big enough to hold on to your atmosphere, but not so big that you make an atmosphere so heavy you end up with a super greenhouse effect and don't have conditions conducive to stable water. So you can see how it's not too hot, not too cold, not too big, not too small. It's a very classic Goldilocks type of problem. Examining these factors, we're going to find that there is in fact a definable zone around our sun, which we refer to as the habitable zone. This is the region in which, all things being equal, is the most likely place where you're going to get stable water existing on the surface, I should have some extra words here, we'll qualify it later, of a terrestrial planet. So we include not only where we are on the solar system, but its size. But this habitable zone turns out not to be a fixed quantity. We're going to meet something called the continuously habitable zone that is going to be a superset of this. It's going to be the habitable zone is the region around the sun where liquid water is stable for the life of the sun. This is part of an introduction to the fact that, as we're going to see starting in next week, talking about life in the universe, stars have lives too, as it were. They are born, they live out through an existence of stable burning, and then they die out, or they change their brightness over time. So stars are not habitable forever and ever. There's actually going to be a window of time during which a star will be habitable. And so all of these pieces together is the first real introduction to an idea that we're going to then apply as we go to other stars. We're going to not only be looking for planets around those stars, but the real goal is to find an Earth-like planet in the habitable zone of that star. And this is the first definition of it, but using our solar system as the beginning for setting the stage. We're talking now about the terrestrial planets, the inner four planets. And let's review very quickly what we saw last week about these planetary surfaces and their atmospheres. We'll start at the top with Mercury. It's the closest planet to the sun. Mercury is a small, cold world. It is solidified most of the way through. It has no present-day geological activity. At the present day, it has no atmosphere. It has a very, very hot day side and a very, very cold night side. So it's a very inhospitable place. You can't have water in any form. It's a dry, dead world. It resembles the moon in many ways. Venus, the next planet out from the sun, is about the same size as the Earth. It's big enough to hold on to an atmosphere. It has geological activity, but there's no evidence of plate tectonics. It all seems to be vertical tectonism, upwelling and downwelling. We do see signs of volcanism in the last few hundred million years. There's even some possible evidence of current-day volcanism, but that hasn't been confirmed. Venus can hold on to its atmosphere, and it's a big atmosphere. It's a thick, hot, heavy carbon dioxide atmosphere that blankets the entire planet, so it has a uniformly hot temperature throughout. And that temperature is extreme, around 750 degrees Kelvin. So hot that, in round numbers, lead, if it doesn't actually melt, will certainly be mushy on its surface. As a consequence of being hot and heavy, over the course of the last few billion years, Venus has lost all of its water. It is bone dry. We detect very little water vapor in the atmosphere of Venus. We detect no water vapor down at the surface. A couple of landers have gone down there, mostly Russian and one U.S. All they see is it's a very hot, heavy carbon dioxide atmosphere. It's so heavy, in fact, that standing on Venus, if you could somehow withstand the heat, you would feel the pressure equivalent to standing at the bottom of the lowest ocean basins on Earth with all the weight of the ocean water above you. It's a very inhospitable place. There's no water. It's super hot. Organic chemistry would basically break down at those temperatures. But we take the Earth. Same starting point, same approximate size, but we move it a little further out. It's geologically active and has plate tectonics, has lateral tectonism, constant recirculation and recycling of the crust. It has a nitrogen and oxygen atmosphere. The nitrogen's what's left over after the carbon dioxide has been slowly scrubbed out over time into the ocean water and locked up in crustal rock, primarily oceanic crustal rock. The temperatures are pretty moderate. Even on a day like this, it's actually pretty nice out there except for the mist. And there is abundant liquid water. 72% of this planet's surface is covered in deep oceans, and everywhere you look, whether you like it or not, there's water, and that water is what powers life. The Earth is the way it is because it is warm and wet and has been so for a very long time. There have been stable liquid oceans on this planet for more than 3.5 billion years. So Earth is an abode of life. Mars, on the other hand, goes further out. It's smaller. It's shrunk below the size that we're now 4.5 billion years old. It's solidified all the way through, and it's geologically inactive. Its magnetic field has collapsed, which no longer allows for protection against the solar wind. So we have a geologically inactive world with no plate tectonics at all, or any kind of tectonics. Volcanism, the last episode of volcanism was maybe 300 million years ago. It's lost most of its atmosphere. It's a very thin carbon dioxide atmosphere. Could have been heavier in the past, but its gravity was too weak, and in the face of a solar wind, wasn't able to hold on to it. The solar wind basically accelerated what would have been a steady loss of the atmosphere due to its weak gravity. It just kind of made things worse. The temperature, as a consequence, is extremely cold. First of all, it's far from the sun. Second, doesn't have much of an atmosphere to sustain a greenhouse effect, despite being a CO2 atmosphere. The temperature is too cold for liquid water. All the water on the planet has frozen out. There is solid water now. It's all subsurface. There may have been a point, though, in the distant past, a billion years after formation, when there's some evidence to show that there was abundant liquid water on the surface of Mars. There we certainly see the evidence of geology and chemistry that has occurred in the presence of liquid water, but mostly mineralogy. This holds out the possibility that Mars may once have at least had a very brief period when it was habitable, but it no longer is. It is a dry, cold desert. Four worlds. Four very different outcomes. Even though their basic starting points were about the same, all started with heavy carbon dioxide, water vapor, nitrogen atmospheres. But all of those atmospheres evolved in different ways. They're all different places from the sun, so the amount of solar radiation was part and parcel of driving how those atmospheres evolved. Closer to the sun, the atmospheres are hotter. Further from the sun, like Mars, they're colder. The size of the planet played a factor. Mars and Mercury, too small to hold on to what atmospheres they had. Earth and Venus, quite capable of holding on to their atmospheres. But the proximity of Venus to the sun has made it a very different world from the Earth, even though they may have started out very nearly identical, except for that distance from the sun. So how does this work? What are the factors involved? Well, you've seen this formula before. I showed it a couple of days ago. It's how you compute the equilibrium temperature on the surface of a body, exclusive of greenhouse effects. So this is your starting point. Greenhouse effect just helps you. It can be written down as a temperature times this product of the 1 minus the albedo to the 1/4 power divided by the square root of your distance from the sun. How shiny you are, the shinier you are, you reflect sunlight so you don't heat up as much. The further you are from the sun, the less sunlight you receive. And so quite naturally, objects that are further from the sun will be cooler, as expected. The further you stand from the fire, the colder you are. And shinier objects are cooler at a given distance from the sun. If I took the Earth and went through a snowball ice period and suddenly covered it in ice, the global temperature will drop even more because the ice becomes shiny. So all I've done is I've kept the Earth at the same distance, the sun the same brightness, but I make a dramatic change in the albedo of the Earth by having unusual amounts of snow cover, and I can lead to plummeting temperatures. And situations like that, as we saw previously, set up at least twice in our history a snowball Earth situation, where the entire Earth was covered in ice, even down to a depth of 1 kilometer in the oceans. But today it's warm, so clearly albedo, how shiny you are, and distance matters. But there's one other factor in this equation that I've not talked about before, although you saw a little bit of it on your homework. Namely, there's a final piece of this equation. It also depends upon how bright the sun is. Now, for today, the luminosity of the sun is the luminosity now. This factor is 1, so it doesn't enter into the calculation today. But as the sun goes through its life cycle, it changes its brightness. It was fainter in the past. It's going to be brighter in the future, as we saw in the homework problem you worked the other day. So this adds an additional factor into the what the equilibrium temperature will be at a given distance. A brighter sun will make objects of the same distance and albedo hotter. A fainter sun makes objects at the same distance and with the same distance and albedo cooler. So if the sun gets brighter, it's just like the fire getting more vigorous. You feel warmer standing at the same distance. If the fire dies down, if the sun gets fainter, you feel colder. So there's 3 factors that determine what a planet's temperature is going to be: how shiny it is, how far away it is from its parent star, and how bright its parent star is. By making this formula much more general this way, I can not only apply it to the sun through the sun's history, but I can apply it to other suns. I can apply it to other stars and ask, where are the ranges where I find temperatures conducive to liquid water? So this is the mathematical underpinnings, the physics underpinnings of this idea of a habitable zone. But I want to leave that equation aside because, again, you know, first of all, this is not a math class. And second is I want to build some intuition up as to what goes on. And some of this, again, we've all seen this stuff before here in this class, but now I'm going to put it together in a different way. Suppose the following problem. Take the sun as it is today, present brightness. Take the Earth where it is and say, what would happen if I moved the Earth closer to the sun? Well, if I'm closer to the sun, the sunlight gets brighter. I'm closer to the light. It gets brighter as 1 over distance squared. The temperature, therefore, goes up. I'm standing closer to the fire. I will become warmer. So as you move the Earth closer, everything about the Earth is the same. Its albedo is the same. Its water content, its atmosphere, identical. All I do is move it closer to the sun. The amount of sunlight I receive is more, and the temperature goes up. What does this mean? Well, if I increase the global temperature by increasing the amount of solar radiation, in this case I'm increasing the solar radiation by moving the Earth closer, I increase the surface temperature. Seems plausible. If I increase the surface temperature, the air temperature goes up. If the air temperature goes up, it's easier for water vapor to be evaporated into the air. You can hold more water vapor in the air when it's hot than when it's cold. Right? On a cold day like this, it's about 47 degrees Fahrenheit out there, and it's kind of drizzly. If I was to do that in the summertime, it would feel oppressively hot and muggy because hot air can hold a lot more liquid water vapor. So warmer air holds a lot more water vapor. If water holds a lot more water vapor, then I can get greater infrared absorption. Water vapor is one of those greenhouse gases. That leads to a stronger greenhouse effect. Stronger greenhouse effect traps heat, which raises the local air temperature. So I'm not doing anything about long-term geological stuff. I'm just simply raising the temperature very dramatically, quicker than any geological process. So I get warmer, I get hotter. As I get hotter, my ability to hold water vapor, which is a strong greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, increases. As I increase the greenhouse effect, the atmosphere gets warmer. If it's warmer, it can hold more water vapor. If it holds more water vapor, there's greater greenhouse effect, which raises the temperature, which can hold more water, which raises the greenhouse effect, which raises temperature, and I get a positive feedback loop. The push against the atmospheric system reinforces the very change that occurred. So it's called a positive feedback loop. Now, we always have small seasonal variations in temperature because of tilt of the Earth and things like that. So it's a relatively shallow platform of stability. But if I make a really big change in the global temperature of the Earth, what will happen is the global average amount of water vapor in the atmosphere will increase, which will increase the greenhouse effect, which will increase the global average temperature, which will increase the greenhouse effect, and it snowballs on you. And so what you get is the temperature will begin to rise. Now, normally on the Earth, when we have cycles of warm and cool, ice ages and other, the excursions in temperature are relatively low, and it doesn't affect things like the oceans very much. The oceans change, but they're not dramatically affected. But what if I push the temperature so hard that I begin to evaporate the oceans? I really superheat the Earth. Then the oceans will begin to evaporate. The oceans have a lot of dissolved carbon dioxide in them. So when they evaporate and release their water vapor into the air, they also release their carbon dioxide. Whoops, that's not so good. I've now doubled the greenhouse gas content. I've added water vapor and carbon dioxide. Then you expose those carbonate rocks on the bottom of the ocean to the searing sun. What do? If you bake carbonate rock, take a piece of limestone and put it in a kiln, you bake lime, and you boil off tons of carbon dioxide. You release the carbon dioxide that's tied up in carbonaceous rocks. So now you're baking the bare rock that's carbonaceous, carbon-bearing, and it begins to release its carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which makes the atmosphere heavier, which increases the greenhouse effect, and the whole thing basically runs away. All that carbon dioxide that took billions of years to lock up in the oceans and the crust is suddenly released back into the atmosphere, and you get what's called a runaway greenhouse effect. If you increase the solar brightness enough, you will turn the Earth into Venus, and the system will simply run away to extremely high temperatures where liquid water is no longer stable, where water is only water vapor. Once you turn water into water vapor, you expose water to destruction by ultraviolet radiation. That's what happened on Venus. Venus started out with a relatively runaway greenhouse effect in a very moist, hot carbon dioxide and water vapor atmosphere. But over time, ultraviolet radiation attacks the water vapor, breaking it down into oxygen and hydrogen. And the water vapor basically is lost to the planet, drying it out over a billion years or so. So a runaway greenhouse effect is really catastrophic. Not only do you put most of your water vapor in the atmosphere, but when you do that, you expose it to water loss, and the planet will dry out over long times. So increasing the global temperature beyond a certain threshold will actually lead to the atmosphere becoming unstable and going into a runaway greenhouse effect. That's what happened to Venus, because it was so close to the sun. Same starting point as the Earth, but it had that much more solar radiation, because it's 0.8 AUs away, not 1 AU. That extra temperature, Venus never stabilized its atmosphere. It ran away in this thermal runaway greenhouse effect. So the answer is, if you move the sun closer to the Earth, the Earth closer to the sun, it becomes too hot. It will become like Venus. You will trigger a runaway greenhouse effect. We can calculate where this should occur with reasonable models of how climates like the Earth behave. If I was to move the Earth to 0.84 astronomical units, I would get that full-up, flat-out runaway greenhouse effect. But I don't have to go that far. I only have to go to 0.95 AU. That's only 5% closer than it is now. Then I will start triggering the moist greenhouse, where I start returning so much water vapor to the atmosphere that I tip the balance away from the equilibrium that it enjoys today. So the Earth is really balanced kind of on the edge of a knife in terms of its stability. Move it 5% closer to the sun, I trigger a moist greenhouse effect. Move it 16% or 15% closer to the sun, and I trigger a complete runaway. I make the Earth like Venus. So I get higher temperatures, more upper atmosphere water vapor, water atmosphere in the upper atmosphere ultimately gets destroyed by UV radiation. So once you go down this road, there's no going back. Once you start losing your water, that's it. Game over. You are going to be like Venus. So we can't turn the Venus into Earth unless we could somehow deliver one hell of a lot of water to it. Because Venus has no water. Remember, it's water dissolving carbon dioxide and raining out into oceans and ultimately precipitating into carbonaceous rocks that scrubs that CO2 out of the atmosphere and leaves the nitrogen behind. That's how our Earth became habitable. But you lose the water, game over. All right, let's go the other way. Let's take the Earth and move it further away from the sun. What happens? I'm further away from the sun, so my received sunlight is fainter. Received sunlight is fainter. I'm standing further from the fire, and the temperature goes down. The Earth's temperature will go freezing, even with its greenhouse effect, 7% further away, at 1.07 AUs. But the greenhouse effect might extend it a little bit. Again, we have a pretty good understanding of how our atmosphere works, but we don't understand exactly where the lines are. So some of these are approximations. Some people think you can actually push this a little bit further out, maybe as far as 1.1 astronomical units, maybe further. A lot of that has to do with details of how the atmosphere responds to dramatic cooling. We have a pretty good idea of what's going to happen with dramatic heating, but it's the cooling part that's hard to understand. One of the factors that makes it hard to understand is that when you cool the planet, you get more cloud cover and snow makes the planet shinier. Making it shinier reduces the amount of cooling. So if snow light and albedo increase is important, that can accelerate the cooling. But on the other hand, there may be some factors that slow that down. So it's really hard to pin those down. But let's play the scenario as we think we understand. As you move further from the sun, it becomes cold. Cold air cannot hold much moisture. And eventually you reach the point where the temperature of the air drops below the freezing point, and the suspended water vapor becomes droplets which freeze, nucleate, and become snow. So you literally begin to get what's called freeze out. The water precipitates out, falls as shiny snow. Snow is shiny. This lowers the planet's albedo. If it lowers the albedo, it lowers the amount of solar heating because you just bounce that sunlight right back into space instead of absorbing it and heating. Now you get colder, but if you get colder, you get more snow. If you get more snow, you get colder, and you get a runaway freeze out. So it works in both directions. I can get a runaway heating. I can also get runaway freeze out. Now again, the physics of runaway freeze out is not as well understood as the physics of runaway greenhouse, but the same basic thing happens. The estimates vary about when this becomes unstable and runs away, when it becomes a positive feedback loop. For something like the Earth, varies between 1.4 and 1.7 astronomical units. It's a difficult calculation to make because of a lot of the uncertainties involved in this, but we think this is how it works. We know that we can actually freeze the Earth solid, but because of the geological activity of the Earth, the fact that carbon dioxide is constantly being pumped back into the atmosphere by volcanoes, quite independent of the surface temperature, right? A volcano doesn't care how cold it is outside. It's stuff bubbling up from the interior. We were able to go through, in our history, at least two snowball Earth episodes, which recovered because of the geological activity of the Earth. So part of the uncertainty that gets into this is, when you say a runaway freeze-out occurs, on what time scale does it occur? Snowball Earth might last 2 million years, but if it recovers with a heavier carbon dioxide content, that's okay. Human beings don't think on million-year timescales. So what is a runaway freeze-out catastrophic to surface life now versus geologically? And that's part of where some of the uncertainty comes from here. Uncertainty meaning just not knowing how to really pose the problem with high accuracy. So to summarize, what you get is if you move away, you get too cold and you freeze out. If you move too close, the atmosphere, the water evaporates and you get a runaway greenhouse effect. So you move in, and you have a classic Goldilocks problem, right? Goldilocks went to see the bears. What did she run into? The porridge. The porridge was either too hot, too cold, or just right. Hence the name, a Goldilocks paradox, or a Goldilocks situation. So the Earth right now is inside of a habitable zone where conditions are just right for there to be stable liquid water for long geological times. Make the Earth closer to the sun today, it would become like Venus. You'd get a runaway greenhouse effect because it's too hot. Move the Earth too far away, you get snowball Earth because it's too cold and the water all freezes out of the atmosphere. start shutting down the carbon dioxide cycle. Eventually, you get it so cold that even with volcanism, there isn't enough carbon dioxide pumped into the atmosphere to reverse the trend. And so you actually get certain far away where the Earth can no longer recover. At our position right here, with the solar radiation the way it is, we were able to the Earth was able to recover from two snowball Earth episodes, according to the geological record. But if you move it far enough away, it never recovers. And that's what defines the inside and the outside of this so-called habitable zone. Now let's take a look at this habitable zone. Looking down on the solar system today, here are the four interterrestrial planets: Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. The sun shining away in the middle. There are two estimates of the size of our habitable zone. The first of these is called the conservative habitable zone, and I've drawn that as this green band, green for life. The inner edge of the conservative habitable zone is at 0.95 astronomical units, so just 5% inside the present-day orbit of the Earth, and it's as far out as 1.4 astronomical units. So it just kisses the orbit of Mars. Mars is on an elliptical orbit. That's why it's a little bit lopsided here. There's another way of doing the computation, which gives us a little bit of an edge, called the optimistic habitable zone, which extends the habitable zone in basically to about halfway between the Earth and Venus, about 0.84 astronomical units, and outwards to about 1.7 astronomical units. Now, the qualifier is, this is for the Earth. Put the Earth inside this region. So I have the Earth with its physical size. It is geologically active, so it is of a size to be geologically active, and it's therefore got active volcanism and an active method to repopulate the atmosphere with carbon dioxide and water vapor. And it has an atmospheric composition similar to what it is today, and the sun is as bright as it is. So with that enhanced greenhouse effect and the fact that the Earth is geologically active, if you're really generous, you can push it out to about 1.7 AUs. And you can see that this actually just encompasses the orbit of Mars, but doesn't make it into the orbit of Venus. So Venus and Mercury, even by the most generous estimations of habitability, are outside the habitable zone. They're too close to the sun. They're too hot. Mars looks like it should be habitable, but it isn't because it's too small. It can't hold on to its atmosphere. If Mars was the size of the Earth, it might be the other harbor of life in our world if this optimistic estimate of the size of our habitable zone is correct. So this is where life can live on the surface of an Earth-like planet. So there's your definition of the habitable zone. It's the place where an Earth-like planet can have stable liquid water on its surface. Okay? So it's the region around the sun where water is stable on the surface of a planet at the pressure of one atmosphere. Now, it turns out there's a couple different ways to make a planet of one atmosphere. I can have a small planet with a heavy atmosphere. As long as it's one atmosphere, it puts me in that sweet spot for liquid stable water, just like you saw in problem 3 the other day. Now you can see how the homework assignment this week was a setup for the basic physics of how we're going to know what to look for around other stars, right? The habitable zone, we can find planets everywhere. In fact, we are finding planets everywhere around most of the stars we look at. But I'm trying to find life. I'm trying to find the needle in the haystack. It's a really good idea, A, to know what a needle looks like, which is why we reviewed the nature of life in such detail. And second, to kind of catch an edge by knowing which of the planets we should be concentrating on. And we should be concentrating on those planets that live inside the habitable zones of their stars. Okay. Questions about this? Because this is a very important concept for the coming weeks. Now, I've alluded to the fact that the planet's size makes a difference here. The size of a planet also influences its habitability. If I made the Earth too small, it would be too small, its gravity too weak to hang on to a warm atmosphere. Over time, its interior would cool off very rapidly, and it would lose its magnetic field. Once the magnetic field collapses, when the planet goes geologically cold, I expose the atmosphere to the ravages of the solar wind, and I can blow it away. So too small is bad. The example of that, of course, as we've mentioned all along, is Mars. Mars is the way it is, not because it was born that way, because it got that way. It evolved that way from its original state. Early in its life, it was inside the optimistic habitable zone. It may have been warm and wet in the first billion years, but A, it was too small to hang on to its atmosphere, and B, Once it froze out, the interior and the magnetic field collapsed. Game over for Mars. It lost its atmosphere. Its temperature plummeted even more. It started acting more and more like a bare rock, and water froze out. Runaway freeze out. Game over. Let's turn around the other way. Let's make the Earth bigger. We're starting to find planets around other stars, which you're going to hear the term super-Earth a lot. These are objects that are 2, 3, 4 times the size of the Earth, but very likely having at least solid surfaces. Well, if you start making the Earth bigger, its gravity gets stronger. As its gravity gets stronger, it can hold on to lighter and lighter gases. Eventually, you cross a threshold, which is a combination of your size and what your surface temperature is, which is based on where you are in proximity to your star, that you can begin to retain hydrogen. Hydrogen is so abundant in the early solar system that once you start building a hydrogen-rich atmosphere, it runs away. You suddenly have an abundant raw material. You build a big, heavy atmosphere. You build a big, heavy atmosphere that's hydrogen-rich and therefore reducing chemistry rules. And you end up with a hot, high-pressure environment that's too hot and high pressure for liquid water. There's a place on that phase diagram for water where if your pressure goes up above a certain point, doesn't matter if you've got a solid surface. Even at room temperature, water is a vapor. You have what's called basically super. It's basically water is just steam. So we could end up with ice world and steam world. Earth in the same place, 1 AU from the sun. Make it bigger, steam world. Too big, steam world. Make it too small, ice ball. Even though it's in the habitable zone. So it isn't just sufficient to be in the habitable zone. You have to be the right kind of planet. And the size limits are pretty generous. If we take our estimates of what we think the factors are in building atmospheres, and there's a lot of wiggle room in this. You can be as small as 2/10 the size of the current day Earth and keep away from ice ball, or as big as 10 times the mass of the Earth. Mars is 10% the mass of the Earth. It's below this limit. So here's this diagram. We've seen this before. We take the mass of the Earth, and we can run it up in various directions. The limit for Earth mass is you kind of run it down to the point where it no longer is able to hold on to things like water vapor. That's what sets the lower limit on the size of the Earth. So this is the limit here. Obviously, we can go down arbitrarily small, but where we would stop is where we stop holding on to water. Once you stop holding on to water vapor, you might be able to hold on to carbon dioxide. Maybe that's another way to set the limit down there. That's probably too generous. It's really going to be where water vapor is, and that's why it sets it to a mass above the mass of Mars. For the upper limit, it's when you start picking up helium and then molecular hydrogen that sets the upper limit on this scale. So I've kept the Earth in place. All I've done is change its mass, change its ability to build either a very heavy atmosphere, or by making its mass too small, rob it of the ability to retain its atmosphere gravitationally. So this now allows us to pose the entire Goldilocks problem. We always tend to pose the Goldilocks problem as not too cold, not too hot, but just right. But remember, the Goldilocks story also included chairs and beds and things like that. Too soft, too hard, just right. This is the full Goldilocks problem, full planetary Goldilocks problem. Not too hot, not too cold. Oops. Yep. Not too hot. Yep. Not too cold. Not too big, and not too small. The reason for emphasizing the not too big, not too small is you're going to get a lot of press right now. In fact, some of you have already seen it. Every time they discover a new planet relatively close to the habitable zone of its star, those involved in the investigation teams immediately file a press release with the New York Times and say, we found a planet in the habitable zone. That's nice. Unfortunately, that planet is 5 times the mass of the Earth, or 8 times the mass of the Earth. It's probably not going to be that interesting a place to look for life, because if its atmosphere is heavy enough, game over. Too hot. Inside or outside is the sort of the goal. We want to find ourselves right in this zone where we're not too big, not too small, not too close, not too far. So it's a pretty narrow zone we've got to basically be in to sustain life on the Earth. This is the problem for searching for life on other worlds. We've got the full planetary Goldilocks problem. So this means a couple of interesting things. Number one, it's going to depend a lot upon the type of star. Very bright stars are going to have their habitable zones in a very different place than a very cool star, a very low luminosity star. Big planets are going to have a different habitability range, if at all, than small planets. So this is now telling us what we're looking for. We're actually, in many ways, kind of fortunate. The Earth is in kind of exactly the right spot. So we're not so big, small, that we can don't lose our atmosphere. Not so big that our atmosphere is too big. Not so small that we have a cold interior, which has certain risks and long timescales. And so this is now where liquid water can exist. That's that habitable zone I just drew in the green band. And now there's the blue box. If you want to be habitable in the present day in our solar system, you got to be in that little box. But look at how much of the solar system is left, which is uninhabitable on its surface. So this habitability zone, which includes temperature and size, just like I drew before, is an illustration of just the really narrow zone of habitability in our own solar system. This is what it is today. Okay, the planets are 4.5 billion years old. The sun is as bright as it shines whenever it's clear. But this is not going to be true over the entire history of the sun. Because we also have to take into account the fact that there's another piece of that puzzle, namely how bright your star is. The sun changes its brightness with age. In fact, the sun gets steadily brighter as it ages. This plot, you saw a subset of this on your homework, plots the age of the sun from birth at zero. Present day is about 4.6 billion years right here. The sun is a little bit older than the Earth, because it took the Earth time to form after the sun lit off. And this blue line shows you the brightness of the sun as a function of time. Right now, today, we're right here at 1 times the luminosity of the sun. This is L over L sun today. I've also plotted the size of the sun. The sun actually grows a little bit in size. It puffs up a little bit. And its temperature actually goes up. It gets a little bit hotter on its surface, and then it turns over here. For reasons I won't explain, go take 162. But the blue line's what I care about. 4.5 billion years ago, the sun was about 70% its current brightness. That means the Earth would have been about 8.5% cooler in round numbers. This is pretty close to freezing, but there's a lot of carbon dioxide in the air. The Earth started with a hot, heavy carbon dioxide atmosphere. So even though it had a big greenhouse effect, the sun was fainter, so it didn't run away. And the system was able to stabilize with liquid water, rained out the oceans, and again, as we saw before, 3.5 billion years ago, we had actually 3.8 billion years ago, we had well-established oceans on the Earth. The sun began to get brighter, but at the same time, the Earth's atmosphere was getting lighter because of the carbon dioxide scrub out due to the liquid water cycle. But the sun is not going to wait for us. The sun is going to continue getting brighter. And we can predict how bright it's going to be in the future because we actually have very good models for the behavior of systems like the sun, and we can see lots of examples of sun-like stars throughout our galaxy to test our models against. We see stars that are just being born, we see stars that are just about to die, and all stages in between. It's like looking at a population of people, right? Average lifespan of an American, for example, in the U.S., is around 72, 75 years. But you don't have to spend 75 years to piece together the life cycle of a human being. You have to walk outside, and in one afternoon, you can see everything from a pregnant female, a baby, a toddler, a child, us, old folks, really old folks, and maybe even see a funeral drive by. One afternoon, you can see the entire spectrum of the life cycle of a human being laid out because people of different ages exist at the same time. Same is true of stars. There are stars throughout the universe of all different ages, and we've learned over the last century how to read that and how to be able to piece together the life cycle of stars. And so we can predict with tremendous, really good accuracy what the sun's going to behave like. 1.1 billion years from today, when the sun is about 4.5.7 billion years old, the sun will be 10% brighter. That 10% brightness is enough to raise the temperature on Earth to start this process where liquid water evaporation becomes unstable, and you start triggering what's called a moist greenhouse effect, where the atmosphere becomes humid, super humid, and begins to be a greenhouse trap. So that's the first instability, and it's triggered about 1.1 billion years from now when the sun is about this bright here. But the sun keeps getting brighter 3.2 billion years from now. So 3.2 billion years, see we're about there. So it's when the sun is about 7.8 billion years, so about there. The sun is 30% brighter than it is today, 36% brighter to be precise. Actually, what happened is here I moved this curve up without moving my dots, so those dots should be up on the blue curve. The sun will be 30% brighter, and this will trigger a runaway greenhouse effect. To put it in the context of our habitable zone, making the sun 30% brighter is equivalent to taking the Earth and moving it to the present-day position of the planet Venus. So instead of moving the sun, the Earth in to make the sunlight hitting it brighter, I keep the Earth where it is and turn the brightness up on the sun, although nature is going to do that for me. So this means that while the Earth started out pretty habitable, we think the Earth was a habitable place of stable liquid water 3.8 billion years ago. It's not going to last forever. That epoch of stable water on the Earth is going to end 1.1 billion years in our future, and it will dramatically come to an end 3.2 billion years in the future when the Earth becomes like Venus and will definitively dry out and will end. The Earth, life on Earth and Earth's habitability is going to end long before our sun dies. The sun has got a long ways to go. About 10 billion years is when it runs out of hydrogen. And then it's still got another billion years of kind of sick feebleness waiting for it, where it's going to do some really spectacular stuff, which is going to basically strip the atmosphere off our planet and make us like the moon. But the important point is here is you don't have to simply look at a star and say, where are we in the habitable zone? The position of that habitable zone changes with time. So as the sun ages, the habitable zone, in effect, moves outward. So this is that same plot. Now, this is one stolen from your book. The dashed line is where we are today, and these are the outer limits of the optimistic and the conservative habitable zone today. The orbit of Mars, the orbit of the Earth, and the orbit of Venus. As the sun gets brighter, those habitable zones move out until about 1.1 million billion years from now. We cross outside of the conservative habitable zone, and this calculation here at 3.2 billion years from now, we cross outside of the optimistic habitable zone limits. But you'll notice there's a place in here where you can see that if you were just a little bit further in, further out, the Earth would be habitable for a lot longer. And you can define something which is called the continuous habitable zone. So Venus and Mars were always at the edge. They never really had much of a chance. If Venus was going to be even marginally habitable at the beginning, it basically was outside even the conservative limit and at least went into a moist greenhouse effect from day one. Mars kind of had a fighting chance for a while. It started out a little cold, but it really barely had a chance. Maybe in the future, it passes fully into the habitable zone. It's too late for Mars. It's lost its atmosphere and probably isn't going to ever recover. That could be wrong. Maybe something interesting will happen, but no one's really sure what's going to happen. But eventually what's going to happen, as we just saw in a different way, is the habitable zone moves out and leaves the Earth behind. It leaves the Earth on the inside edge of the habitable zone, which is the runaway thermal death zone. Now, similarly, you might have a star. If a star was suddenly getting fainter, the habitable zone will move in. So this allows us to define something called the continuously habitable zone. The continuously habitable zone is that range of distances around a star where a planet can have stable liquid water on its surface for the entire lifetime of that star. That's extremely narrow for our solar system. But there are places in the universe where that can happen because the ages of stars are different. Stars like our sun live 10 billion years. Hotter stars live less time. Cooler stars live a longer time. But remember, this idea of a habitable zone is really important to how we actually go around looking for planets. It really informs our choices, but there's some caveats. The first caveat, as we've seen for extremophiles on the Earth and the speculations about Europa and Enceladus, is there are other sources of energy than sunlight. Chemical energy, for example, near hot subsurface vents. Life didn't start on the surface of our planet. It started deep in the oceans, far away from sunlight. So sunlight's only part of the story. Tidal heating is another source of heat. Tidal heating and radioactivity are what are keeping Europa, Io, and Enceladus with hot interiors, even though geologically speaking, they should be completely cold and dead. because they're constantly being reheated by interaction with the strong gravity of Jupiter, in the case of Io and Europa, and the gravity of Saturn and the resonant moons, in the case of Enceladus. So this idea of a habitable zone is very good to guide our searches, guide our thinking about life around other worlds, but it shouldn't restrict it. There may be other possibilities we should be open to. And so this now sets the stage for what is life like in the solar system? How do we define it? We're now ready to go out and look for life around other stars.